New Yorkers come together to resist police brutality and demand free transit by Lolly B, 2-8-2020. I saw red stickers on the NYC subway that read, "Decolonize this place." As an activist focused on the intersection of climate crisis and indigenous human rights, I wanted to learn more. I was excited to attend meetings for this decentralized movement growing in New York City. The movement was birthed last fall as a reaction to the excessive use of force by the NYPD against youth of color for committing low-level crimes such as turnstile hopping. FTP1 was called for out of an initial response last November to the violence expressed against brown and black youth for being unable to pay $2.75 to move around the city. Momentum picked up as FTP2 came together in November 2019 as a more general response to the racist and classist policing policies throughout the city and the transit system. For FTP3, it was clear that more groups and individuals were following and interested in participating. Several planning meetings were held on the NYU campus in the East Village, reviewing the manual developed in preparation for the event and offering the opportunity to develop more relationships among inspired people. The four demands of the movement are to get cops out of the MTA, to have free public transit, to provide full accessibility for people of all mobilities, and to get cops off of school campuses. The pattern of policing in the subways is structured to target already historically oppressed populations, considering a January 13, 2020 article on NBC's website stating, "Black and Hispanic people accounted for nearly 90% of fare-related arrests and nearly 70% of summonses from October 2017 to June 2019, according to NYPD data." The Attorney General's office under Leticia James promises to investigate this further to determine what is causing such skewed policing. This disparity prompts the rejection of the police presence in the MTA since it continues historical criminalization of people of color and institutional racism. The FTP3 manual was developed by core organizers of Decolonize This Place and lays out the essential values and expectations. It opens with a territorial acknowledgement of the Lenape people, the indigenous caretakers of the land now known as New York City. One page defines the values. Quote, "Our uprisings are queer, trans, black, brown, Palestinian, immigrant, indigenous, and global." The FTP formation principles of unity explain, "We understand that this formation is black, brown, and indigenous led." It also goes on to specify that we do not allow white saviorism. In the training, the practice of white presenting people placing themselves between people of color and the police is explained and expected. The principles of unity state that all agree to a diversity of tactics, hardcore resistance, community outreach, political education, mutual aid, jail, prison, captivity support, formalized training, fundraisers, and documentary evidence producing. It also rejects divisive behaviors such as accusations and gossip while asking anyone to disclose their professional affiliations. The powerful aspect is that there is no specific group that anyone joins. If you share the ideals defined in the statements, you are now a part of it. The impact of this movement is in its effective ability to manage but not control, to disseminate information without maintaining authority, to inspire but not rank various groups with overlapping goals. I asked one of the core organizers what it's like to manage the growing movement with no definitive leaders. He responded, "It's not that it's leaderless, it is leaderful." He went on to explain that it operates on an affinity model, in concentric circles, so it doesn't have a vertical structure, which is not in the interest of anyone. It doesn't have a pyramid, which can easily be broken. There are several affiliate groups which claim to be actively part of this day in ongoing activism. He continues, "The reasons DTP can do this work is because we can mediate between a lot of different groups and make their core struggles seem not in competition. We can add their cause into our own. The core values and goals are defined clearly, and many different organizations can see their own struggle expressed. 15.3 million people in the tri-state area rely on the transit system and the confrontation of the police as an institution which historically targets working class, people of color, and increasingly defends corporate and state interests is a cause which everyone should be alarmed about." According to the Mayor's Office for Economic Opportunity data tool, as of 2017, the percentage of the New York City population living in or near poverty, according to the NYC Gov threshold, is as follows: 27% of white people, 46.8% of black people, 48.5% of Asian people, and 55.5% of Hispanic people live at or near poverty. That is 43.1% of everyone in the city. If you consider working age people only, 18 to 64, who are already living in poverty, it adjusts to be 17.9% of the city. According to an article by Noah Mankar from June 3, 2019, he reports that nearly one in five New Yorkers is poor despite poverty drop, figures show. Almost a fifth of New York City residents are poor. As the crowd marched toward Times Square at 1:31:20, a middle-aged man in business attire shouted at us, "Get a job!" This is not uncommon to hear shouted from those who apparently work in white-collar professions, which typically pay much more than minimum wage. In fact, on July 19, 2018, a study reported in the Daily Gazette found that the top 1% of New York State residents make 44 times more than the bottom 90% statewide. In fact, New York City is reported as of January 18, 2019, to be home to nearly 1 million millionaires, more than any other city in the world, by Kathleen Elkins to NBC, CNBC. The first gathering of the day was 9 a.m. on the steps of City Hall, led by the Free CUNY movement. The central demands are free, high-quality education for all, the removal of police from campuses, as well as free access to transportation for all students. The complaints were about harassment of students of color on campuses, delaying them on their way to class, and making them feel targeted in a place of learning. Accessibility to classes is dependent on most students utilizing public transportation. I spoke with a 19-year-old student of gaming and journalism who literally joined the protest the day of when she found out what the crowd was about, because she had been ticketed $100 for jumping a turnstile, when as a young student she explained that she had no other option. Alisa Grillon with the People's Cultural Plan shared her thoughts after the event, saying, "The action was from the need to begin looking at education in the U.S. from the perspective of forcing Indigenous children into Indian reservation schools, anti-literacy laws against African Americans, and the repression of student movements beginning in the 1950s in black and brown schools. Militarized education to oppress has always been on the agenda, and it has to end. I enjoyed that she was giving out teachers' stickers of celebration to all in attendance." Some student groups then continued onto the trains to share the message and invite others to come to Grand Central that evening. "It's not a question about resources. We have enough resources. It's a question about power. So we encourage you all to join the movement against the further criminalization of poverty. Poverty is not a crime." The group echoed the words of one student together. An anticipated action at the Barclays station at 1 p.m. in Brooklyn was met with dozens of NYPD officers and two large corrections buses. A helicopter hovered overhead as a friend and I scoped the scene. Officers stood around chatting above ground and around the subway entrance. There had been some communication about doing a mass turnstile hop similar to the last action, but upon recognizance of NYPD's massive presence, it seemed to be concluded to be more risk than it was worth. That did not stop untold numbers of people accessing the trains throughout the day, either due to their own initiative of entering without payment or thanks to the convenience of emergency exit doors being locked open for all to move freely. Allegedly, small groups had taken action throughout the MTA to prevent swipe or Omni use, requiring doors to be opened, allowing full mobility to all regardless of economic resources. A legal option also encouraged is for anyone to utilize their unlimited card to swipe a fellow human into the system at the end of their ride, which is an officially allowed policy called Swipe It Forward. Hundreds of people heard the call put out on social media and on flyers and stickers throughout the MTA. Everyone showed up in Grand Central Station, New York City, at 5 p.m. on January 31st. The crowd was made up of a diversity which reflected the many colors and creeds of one of the planet's busiest cities. The New York Police Department response was excessive, a militarized display of force meant to intimidate anyone rebellious enough to walk around with a sign. The long-distance acoustic device, the LRAD, sat covered on a truck outside the station, in case the crowd became too unruly and required increasing levels of non-lethal force. Meanwhile, inside the iconic Great Hall, youth held up banners reading, "We keep us safe, free public transit, tax Wall Street bandits," as well as the pipelines. Swarms of officers in dark blue were scoping out targets in the moving march of resistance. A middle-aged woman was carrying balloons and golden letters reading FTP when a large officer barreled through the crowd to swipe them out of her hand. Was this part of his fulfillment to serve the people, to remove balloons out of a woman's hand? Commuters in long gray peacoats hurriedly navigated to their train platform, mostly ignoring the action, although I saw a few lay people recording the activity. Various outfits of police, military, anti-terrorism, and transit officers were stationed around the terminal. It is unclear what exactly they were expecting. It seems they did not understand that our goal was not to occupy the site for a long time, nor cause any more disruption beyond making a statement in a place it would be noticed. The military officers in green fatigues, the black German shepherds pacing around, the large rolls of zip ties hanging off of the blue uniforms were easy examples of the exact violence that the movement rejects. Eight banners had been meticulously painted during evenings leading up to J31, reading different messages such as, poverty is not a crime, become ungovernable, NYPD out of the MTA, and make the MTA fully accessible. About 20 people had gathered a block away to receive the banners and determine their placement. The station was buzzing with police activity, and officers stood on every step and shoulder to shoulder along the balcony. The NYPD confiscated at least three banners. One was taken right out of an individual's bag by a female officer. When the person attempting to express themselves said, "You can't do that," she responded, "I know," and did it anyway. This was told to me moments after we left the station by an eyewitness who was unable to display his banner. "I felt it was an infringement on my freedom of speech and right to create and present art," said an organizer from an affiliate group who unfurled the banner for a moment before an officer grabbed it from her. When one of the activists, who also happens to be a lawyer, went to retrieve this personal property the following Monday, he was reportedly treated condescendingly and his belongings were not given back. This is an example of an unjust policy called civil asset forfeiture, which entitles police to keep items which are associated with the crime. However, no one is directly being charged for having a piece of canvas in their hands, and it seems illegal for NYPD to keep it without proper protocol. Police ostensibly are meant to protect the public safety and serve the people. However, the only humans who were hurt on Friday were civilians, thrown to the ground or body slammed into walls by the so-called peace officers. As we marched around Brooklyn, I watched an undercover officer in a flannel shirt leap in front of me and take down a young man in a headscarf. There was absolutely no warning, no communication, no declaration of anyone's identity. The first hand placement of the officer was on the far right shoulder of the youth, hurling him to the ground to the left, followed by the grown man's own shoulder thrust down onto the arrestee's back. Despite having witnessed and knowing about police violence before, I was shaken. Comparing this officer's behavior as most similar to the way a tiger takes down a deer for its survival. This was a predator-to-prey example of violence. This was not a trained professional keeping the community safe. The offense which caused the activist to be ambushed and bruised was scribbling with a marker onto a bus stop as the crowd marched along. He is 15 years old. According to The Intercept's report on May 9, 2018, plainclothes officers are often known to exhibit more force and to be involved in more shootings than those in uniform. Throughout the march on Friday, people would point to a man and indicate that he is an undercover officer. A closer look at their jacket could reveal the outline of a gun. A woman a few rows in front of me while we walked to Times Square wrote on a window, only to be immediately and aggressively shoved into the wall while a man in a black sweatshirt whipped handcuffs out, and she struggled against him since he had not declared his identity before touching her. The activist filed out of Grand Central Station after it became evident the police were picking out people to dramatically arrest. This was not the main event, contrary to the police expectations of usual protests. The highlight of the day's actions was actually happening on dozens of subway cars as the police were left loitering in the train station. I found myself in the Times Square station with some of the leading matriarchs representing the Swipe It Forward and Black and Indigenous Liberation movements. Their voices echoed through the crowded train as one elder named Ramsey Orta and Eric Garner, the former imprisoned and the latter murdered by the NYPD in 2014. The grandmother's voice was amplified by the rest of us spreading the message on the subway, repeating her words. "This is a continuation of sustained indignation of police brutality, of murder of black and brown people. This is sustained indignation of the occupation of Lenni Lenape land." We shared the four demands of the movement in multiple cars, galvanizing others to cheer with us. We exited the MTA into a hive of officers, some shining flashlights into our faces. Officers streamed down the stairs in response to our arrival, and I watched one shove the small woman in front of me for absolutely no reason. Once in Brooklyn, smaller cohorts linked together to continue marching on the sidewalks or in Restoration Park. We cheered, "Black Lives Matter, Brown Lives Matter, Blue is a job, that don't matter," to emphasize the fact that police officers have the choice to partake in a different profession, but when officers kill an unarmed civilian, there is no second chance for them. Several people were arrested for walking in the street. When one man was on the ground and his friend stepped off the sidewalk in order to hear his legal name, the second man was immediately and excessively apprehended as the crowd chanted, "Who do you serve? Who do you protect?" I found myself in a corner, face to face with an officer who appeared to be a person of color. His eyes were not glazed over in rage as many of his colleagues. I asked him how he feels working for a system founded in white supremacy. I prompted him, wondering how it must feel to have to warn his hypothetical son to be wary of police officers who could kill him with impunity due to institutional racism and excessive force. He did not answer me, but I choose to believe that he may have seeds planted in his awareness. My heart swelled to see two young women with white cloth tied in their hair, a tradition of the Diné people of the Southwest. Members of the Indigenous Kinship Collective, an affiliated group for the FTP 3-Day, represented the original people of Turtle Island. Their Instagram post about the event reads, "I want more for Indigenous folks, for Black folks, for undocumented folks, for all the marginalized people of color. Cops are a toxin of white supremacy and settler colonialism. No cops on stolen land." One of the principal values of the movement is Indigenous sovereignty. The voice of Native people is crucial to restoring justice on these lands. This movement echoes the philosophy of the Rainbow Coalition, founded in Chicago in 1969. Ray Santisteban said about the documentary he spent 12 years making that various resistance groups, quote, "began to form alliances across lines of race and ethnicity with other community-based movements in the city. It is currently available for free until 2/26/20 on the website of PBS. The intention of the Black Panthers, Young Lords, and the Young Patriots was to collectively confront issues such as police brutality and substandard housing. The reflection of these ideals continues today with the core demands of the movement. Sadly, that hope for progress through alliance was tainted by the state-sanctioned murder of Fred Hampton, the voice of the coalition. Today, the same power and collaboration remains, as well as the same risk of speaking out. But the ability to connect across communities is as easy as adding accounts on Instagram." The founder of Climate Justice Rebellion, an affiliate group, when asked about critiques of vandalism during the day's actions, responded by saying, "Being nice and respectable towards power doesn't change society for the better. The reality of police violence, racism, and economic inequality vandalizes people's lives in a worse way on a daily basis." I would also hearken to Dr. MLK Jr.'s words that a riot is the language of the unheard. And when the government will not listen to the demand of the people must become ungovernable. The New York Daily News reported that a few days after J31, City Councilman Mark Traeger of Brooklyn introduced legislation to implement free transit. New York can take a big bite out of poverty, mass incarceration, income inequality, and our impact on climate change, he said. When prompted how to fund it, he echoed the voices of CUNY students shouting through the trains on J31 that the city does have the resources to afford it. The day concluded at One Police Plaza, providing jail support to the 45 people whose freedom was sacrificed for the call for justice. Snacks and coffee were provided by activists for each other, standing outside in the cold after a long day. People actually waited overnight until the last person was released on Saturday morning. The mutual aid process of an action includes supporting one another until any charges are dropped or consequences endured. The National Lawyers Guild provides lawyers and had legal observers present throughout the actions. New York Action Medical also participated, offering street medic support for activist groups throughout the day. Fortunately, no significant injuries beyond bruising and trauma from being violently arrested were reported from J31. Spirits were high as we witnessed the power of the people to come together from the myriad perspectives in one of the world's most diverse cities. Young people were inspired to demand a better future. Elders were comforted by the willingness of the youth to take action. Change only comes from making someone uncomfortable, and becoming ungovernable for one day was effective. To join the movement for FTP 4 and upcoming actions, see us online and in the streets.